Hello and welcome to the EU and You. I'm Ellen Gunning, and in this series, I hope to explain the EU and its most important institutions. There are four main institutions in the EU: the Commission, the Court of Justice, the Council of Ministers, and the European Parliament. I'm joined in studio by Eimear Wren, Press Officer for the European Parliament in Dublin, who's going to try to explain how the Parliament works. Thanks for joining me, Eimear.
Thanks. Try being the operative word.
Well, let's begin by looking back on how it all began, if we can. The original idea of the Parliament was that it would be a consultative body, wasn't it, with no real powers, and that it would actually be appointed by members of national governments.
It was. I mean, up until 1979, the members were actually appointed, all right. The idea was that there would be some national political representation in terms of a parliamentary body that would be consulted, that they would feed in with their opinions on legislation, that they would actually get the opinions at a more local level going through onto these pieces of law going through. But also, if you bear in mind that it was a lot of policy areas at the time, the laws have sort of come nearly after the 1979, a lot of the major laws as well.
So the original thrust was just to make sure that in terms of national policy, Europe wasn't going off on a tangent on its own, that it was keeping an eye, but it wasn't seen as important to have representatives who actually represented each individual European citizen.
Well, it was when you think about it, it was the development of the EU from being about member states, governments deciding on particular pieces of law, to actually looking at more feedback into this law, it becoming a more solid, the development of a union of citizens, if you like, over time, that now we have political representatives coming into this and to discuss at EU level. So not just waiting for the governments to come home with a piece of draft law and to say, look, this is what we've got, discuss, that actually they would discuss that at EU level at the time using appointed representatives.
And in 1979, then, we got direct elections for the first time.
The good bit.
How many MEPs does Ireland actually have?
Now we have 12. So this is where we're looking at, you know, the citizens. I mean, we have 500 million citizens in the EU now. So every 5 years we get to go out and decide who's going to represent us. And this is a big thing, and something that, I mean, at this stage, we started, as you say, as a consultative body. We're now looking at an assembly, a European Parliament that has power, that actually co-decides, that decides with the council, with the ministers on laws. This is a major development, and something that is important when the voters go out there every 5 years, to realise that the people they send out there are not just going to sit there, that they're actually going to change laws. They literally go through the text line by line. These MEPs actually have quite a lot of power in terms of what happens to an EU law.
And we have 12 MEPs out of how many? How big is the Parliament?
Well, we've 736 now at the moment.
That's a heck of a lot of people.
It's a lot of people, but think about it. We have a small country. Germany has a little bit more than us in terms of citizens.
They'd be slightly bigger.
Slightly bigger. So that the representatives are going across 27 countries. So if you think about it, that is, do you know what I mean, feeding in. The MEPs don't sit according to national lines. They don't sit, the Irish MEPs don't sit together in the Parliament, and that's an important thing to bear in mind. They sit according to their political allegiances. So let's say the Labour Party MEPs will sit with their counterparts, the Fine Gael MEPs, the Fianna Fáil MEPs. So they don't sit as an Irish grouping. And
so there isn't an Irish group, a Latvian group, a Spanish group?
No. So they don't work for Ireland Inc. in theory. They actually sit in their political groups.
Give me a feeling for this Parliament now for a minute. There are 736 of these people, leaving aside the groups for a second. There are 736 elected MEPs, 12 of whom are Irish. The one thing that struck me when I was thinking about the interview with you was there are never any by-elections for the European Parliament. What happens if somebody dies or somebody retires? I mean, in Ireland,
there's a good one.
We've got this big long queue of by-elections waiting to happen. There always seems to be some by-election that the opposition is pushing for, that it should take place. It never happens with Europe.
Well, the European elections are kind of easy, because when you go into your polling station, when you vote for the European elections, you are not only voting for the candidate, you are also voting for their replacements. Because when a candidate goes forward, they actually submit a replacement list, which is actually on our website. You can actually see who would replace a particular MEP.
Your own MEP if they left.
Yes. Yeah. So when you go in, you're not just voting for your candidate, you're voting for a replacement list too.
And the replacement, I never even noticed that on a ballot paper.
You are now.
The replacement is actually not on the ballot paper.
No. You have to ask for it.
That's okay. Because I was really wondering how I missed that.
And I have great fun with that one.
And out of all of these 736, how many languages are actually spoken? Because it really is a massive multicultural undertaking. Yeah. You've 27 countries.
23 languages in total, including Irish now, it has to be said. Okay, so there are 23 languages. You can imagine the combinations of languages that could mean. So we've got these interpreters that are working in the booths, basically. So you've got the huge chamber that the MEPs would sit in. And all around the chamber, you'll see these booths where the interpreters sit. And they are actually simultaneously interpreting what the MEPs are saying so that it will be available in X amount of languages.
So if I'm speaking in Irish, mm-hmm. I can actually put on my headphones and listen to a translation of what somebody who's speaking French is saying, and it will be translated into Irish for me.
Now, there is where there's a little bit of a problem. At the moment, it is interpreted from Irish into English and into other languages. That's called a relay. Basically, they go through English to get to the other languages. But we don't have interpretation into Irish.
No, but if I want to listen in Irish, I can't listen in Irish.
No, because there's a derogation at the moment, which basically means that there's a delay putting the whole sort of full working language thing in place for Irish. Okay, essentially, when Irish came in, the ministers in the council decided to try for a period of 5 years a limited service in Irish to see how we'd get on. Because in fairness, you had to look for interpreters, for translators, you had to put the whole system in place. And it was a language that they were looking at how many of the Irish MEPs would use it, all of these issues. So they put, I mean, it's not just the Parliament, it's the Council and the Commission as well in terms of the Irish language. So they put this service in place. And at the end of next year, as far as I remember, they're actually going to have to look at whether they're going to keep that limited service in place or
expand
bring it in. So there are a couple of limitations, and one of them is that the interpretation won't come, let's say, from Latvian into Irish.
Okay, that's fair, because that would be a massive undertaking.
To Latvian. Yeah.
How many languages then, if you have all of these booths around the Parliament and they're all translating, how many languages are being translated at any one time?
Well, let's say somebody is speaking in Latvian. It's going to go into the other languages. It'll be made available in all of the other languages except Irish.
So there are 22 other translators working at any one time.
Yeah. It's an amazing thing to watch.
And if you have, I just have to say with this for a minute now, you have 736 parliamentarians in this chamber. You have 22 different, they're speaking 23 different languages, the 22 of which are translated. And so they can all understand at any one time what anybody else is saying. Can they all speak on everything that comes before the Parliament? So could, in theory, 736 say, do you know what? There's a piece of legislation here going through about credit unions and I want to comment on it.
Well, we've got an agenda which is set out before they go into that room. Okay. There are elements now of, you know, what they call a catch the eye, where you can literally put up your hand and, do you know what I mean, stop. There's also a big thing the Irish MEPs are good at is using this thing called the 1 minute speech at the beginning of the session, which they can make a 1 minute speech on an issue that they think should be raised at this level. But in general, the agenda items are set beforehand and the timing in terms of who gets to speak for how long is allocated beforehand based on your membership of a group or, do you know what I mean?
So it's like the Irish Parliament, that in theory, the Fianna Fáil group would get so long to speak, Fine Gael will get so long,
exactly,
Labour will get
exactly.
so long. So the Parliament does exactly the same in terms of their groups.
Yeah. They're okay. Exactly the same thing.
Tell me about the 1 minute speech. Can that be on any topic at all? Or is it on
a topic
closely aligned to the agenda topics?
No, a topic, any topic that they would like. Do you know what I mean? So, but it would generally be considered something that they would consider should be raised at that level. So the range
is incredible.
And the
Irish MEPs, you were saying, are particularly good at using
this. They're particularly good at using this. Yeah.
Clever.
And actually, what is interesting is that in a couple of cases, what they have raised at that level has then developed into sort of questions to the other institutions, developed into putting pressure on the commission, let's say, to bring forward a draft law.
So it's not just a 1 minute speech. It really is a 1 minute speech that grows legs and
Not all the time, but there are instances. Do you know what I mean? Blind spot mirrors was one of them that I remember. Do you know what I mean? Where it started as a 1 minute speech, but then actually bit by bit became an issue. These are blind spot mirrors on lorries, by the way. Do you know what I mean? Going down.
Yes, where people it's a fair point, where people actually couldn't see. There was a section when they looked back in the mirror that was actually blinded out to them, so they couldn't see a cyclist coming on their inside or whatever.
But it's an example of what can come out of it.
And what about the catch your eye idea? Yeah. I presume that's if you feel passionately about something that you hadn't actually planned to speak on, but somebody says something.
It's related to an item on the agenda. it would be the kind of thing where a section of time would be allocated for Catch the Eye, and you'd be trying to put your point across.
Okay, so the majority of the time has been allocated, yeah. And you know who's going to speak, yeah. And yeah. They've prepared their speeches.
And it's all ready before.
But if I feel really hot about this issue, I can try to catch the eye.
If there is a catch the eye section.
Okay. We've been mentioning the Parliament and the fact that 736 people all sit together, but they all sit together in two different locations, in Brussels and Strasbourg. The Parliament actually bilocates. How did that come about?
Well, there are three locations, really, if you think about it, because unfortunately there's Luxembourg too. Okay. It's agreed in the treaties. The Parliament doesn't choose to go waltzing around Europe.
Okay.
It's something that's in
imposed on them.
In the treaties. No, but the thing that's interesting about it is that when, on a very simple level, when Germany got a little bit bigger, when it reunited, and they were doing the treaty negotiations looking at how many extra MEPs Germany would get and all of these issues that came about at the time, one of the issues that France came up with was, well, okay, but what about Strasbourg? Do you know what I mean? We need to make that permanent. And it went into the treaties. The thing about going into the treaties, the reason that sounds that that's an important issue is that a treaty cannot be changed unless all of the member states agree on it.
So the Parliament, does it meet month on, month off in Brussels and Strasbourg?
It'll meet.
And Luxembourg?
12 times a year. The Parliament in plenary session, as in all of them sitting together, will never meet in Luxembourg. That is basically where some of the staff is based, and less actually over time. But in Brussels and Strasbourg, yes, they do meet. Strasbourg would be the big thing for the full plenary session. But in general, there are 12 sessions a year in Strasbourg. And then about four or five in Brussels. The Brussels ones are much shorter.
And Luxembourg would be courts of justice and things like that. It would be the other kind of.
Well, Luxembourg has some parliament staff
arms.
As well. But yeah. A lot of it has actually moved to Brussels at this stage. But according to the treaties, the institutions have three seats. So therefore, they cannot move all of them to Brussels, let's say. And the thing is that the parliament will never move out of Strasbourg until the French remove that veto.
Then it would probably never move out of Strasbourg. Tell me, you were mentioning the treaties. The European Parliament, not only has it changed from being people who were nominated to Parliament but and now have become directly elected, but they've also got an awful lot of teeth over the years. Since the first direct elections in 79, the Single European Act in the 80s was probably the first move towards creating more power for the MEPs.
The nitty-gritty of the laws were coming out of it as well. Do you know what I mean? Going through into Maastricht. I mean, that's when a lot of this, I mean, okay, the laws, you know, were starting over time, but a lot of the impetus, if you like, for the European community, the European Union, happened around that time. Bit by bit, I mean, you're looking at different areas. I mean, the environment would have been a big area where the MEPs had a lot of say, but it depended on if you moved then into agriculture. I mean, agriculture wouldn't have been something that the MEPs had this co-decision right on. Co-decision being that they had equal power with the ministers. This is something that, let's say, the last treaty, Lisbon, has given them, so that the MEPs have the same power as the ministers on areas like agriculture and fisheries, which is a completely new thing for them.
That's a huge change in the amount of power that they have.
Absolutely. And now, they would have had some elements to do with the environment, because, as I say, over time they had that power in relation to the environment. So areas in agriculture that had an impact on the environment, yes, they had some power over, but this is a big change for the MEPs.
And this co-decision, is that the main change? That I know that there have been changes through the Single European Act, through Maastricht. Is that the biggest change?
Co-decision has existed. It's just that it has grown over time in terms of the amount of areas the MEPs can use it. Do you know what?
So it's
the MEPs
constantly
can use
expanding.
It. Exactly. And we're now in a position where in the majority of EU areas of EU law, the MEPs have co-decision powers, and that is a big deal at this stage.
And you were mentioning that the parliamentarians, when they actually come into Parliament, they don't operate as national groups. Mm-hmm. They operate within different groups. Yeah. How are the groups organised? I mean, they're not organised, if they're not organised on national lines, and I presume you don't have one or two people sitting in a Fianna Fáil group and two or three people sitting in a Fine Gael group. So how are the groups actually put together?
So basically, when you become an MEP, you become part of another political group. So do you know what I mean? Fine Gael became part of the EPP when Ireland joined. Fianna Fáil used to be part of another group, the UEN, which no longer exists. They are now part of the Liberal group, which is ALDE. And then the Labour Party are in the Social and Democratic group. Excuse me. So that over time, that has developed. But then you look at, let's say, Marion Harkin, who is an independent MEP. She is part of the Liberal group because she decided that that was the group she wanted to join, that that suited her political priorities.
So the groups are actually based on ideologies, really, are they?
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same as at home. Do you know what I mean? Exactly the same. It's just that they're at a European level. So they bring in parties. I mean, obviously the titles will be slightly different, but they bring in parties that actually have the same types of ideologies.
So when you're, well, a Fianna Fáil group, it's a good point about Marianne Harkin. Fianna Fáil group, the Fianna Fáil body decides this is the group that our people will belong to.
Exactly.
In Marianne Harkin's case, she looks
was
at
independent.
Each of the different groups and says which one most closely represents
exactly.
the kind of ideology that I'm bringing to the European Parliament. How much power then do each of those groups wield?
Well, they are very important because the amount of seats, let's say, that they have between them determines, or the amount of members they have between them determines the amount of speaking time they have, determines the amount of, let's say, in a committee, and it's something, do you know what I mean, we should probably talk about, but that when, let's say, a draft law comes into the European Parliament, it goes into a committee. And the committee has members from the different political groups. And again, it's shared on the basis of size. And those committees then amend the laws, change the laws. And it is that that then goes to the full session to be voted on.
Which
so everything is based on these political
fair
groups.
Fair reflection of if the largest group really does reflect the largest or the most dominant ideology in Europe, then it seems fair that they would wield a little bit more power. Tell me a little bit about the committees and how they operate, because that is really where all the action
where
takes
a lot of
place
the action
the
takes place. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. I mean, just going back to, do you know what I mean, the largest group having the ideology, do you know what I mean, the most dominant ideology in Europe, just one point on that is that what was always interesting in an Irish context is that Fianna Fáil, which was in government, was part of a small political group until recently, whereas Fine Gael was part of the biggest political group in the Parliament. And that was always interesting in an Irish...
That is interesting, because as the government party, you would have expected them to be in the larger group in Europe.
Exactly. So do you know what I mean? It means that, I mean, you constantly had to be aware of that going over to the European Parliament. However, within that political group, Fianna Fáil had a president. One of the presidents of their group was Irish. So he had quite a say then in what happened to the agenda and everything. So, I mean, it kind of worked out in some ways for them. But now they're in one of the bigger political groups, the third biggest political groups in the Parliament. Group in the Parliament. So it's just a...
So they have proportionately more influence, but in a different
exactly.
way.
Exactly. Yeah. So just it's something to be borne in mind. In the committees then, what happens is that when this draft law comes in from the European Commission, it goes to the ministers and to the MEPs in the Parliament. And in the Parliament, basically, somebody is assigned... from a political group, from within the committee, somebody will be assigned to look after that draft law, to accept what the lobbyists have to say, to accept what their fellow MEPs have to say. They will be the focus of all attention in terms of working on that particular law. One of the bigger pieces, if you like, you know, the trade in emissions. You know,
yes, yeah.
That particular one was done by Avril Doyle, done by an Irish MEP. It's one of the biggest pieces of law that went through the Parliament. But she was chosen based on, do you know what I mean, her work in the Parliament, based on her interest in the area, based on her work in that committee. She was chosen to draft that particular law on behalf of the Parliament.
So each committee, every law that comes before the Parliament, this is now an idiot proof, but I'm trying to get it clear in my head. Each committee, any law that comes before the Parliament, there is a committee which actually looks at it.
Yeah.
That committee then appoints one person, in essence, to try and distill what the civil service, the commissioner, actually recommending to them, what the lobbyists are saying shouldn't be done, what their own national representatives are saying represents their interest. And one person, and in the case of that bill, Avril Doyle, actually pulls it all together and says, then this should be the Parliament's position.
Exactly. This should be the Parliament's position. Now, that is at the committee level. As I say, that is where the nitty-gritty happens, because a lot of the amendments are happening at that stage, these changes to the law, because the different members of the committee will have pressures from their political groups to make sure that their amendments are going through. And then when they're finished with that, it's sent on to the plenary session. But there are a lot of negotiations then, as you can imagine, because the Council of Ministers are also deciding on it at the same time. There's a lot of negotiations going back and forth in terms of the different positions, because one way or another, those two institutions have to agree if it's going to become a law.
Yeah, so it's now, going to be co-decision. It makes it much easier if they're both, to use that awful expression, singing from the same hymn sheet, but if they're both on the same track.
Yeah, now they don't really sing from the same hymn sheet, as you can imagine, because, I mean, if we go back to where we started with this, you know, consultative assembly and the size of this European Parliament, you are talking about parliamentary representatives. You are talking about people who are elected by citizens in the countries solely to do this job. And then you're talking about ministers who are coming to represent their government. So you've got a very different...
They're coming at it from two entirely different perspectives.
So it's a question of trying to negotiate a position, which means that the interests of both sort of groups are represented. And that then becomes the law. And it is a very difficult thing to do. And what's happening in the Parliament now more and more is that, okay, it comes from that committee, which is, you know, where a lot of the changes happen. It goes to the plenary session, and until the full plenary session, all of the MEPs vote on it, it doesn't become the Parliament's position. But at that stage, it's going there. But a lot of amendments are coming in there now as well.
It actually explains how it takes so long to get anything done in the European Parliament. But you can also understand that somebody who wasn't possibly on that committee, who mightn't have been aware of the kind of discussions that the committee were having, and suddenly becomes conscious of it when it comes to Parliament and says, oh my God, no, I have to make a contribution on this element because I really strongly feel that shouldn't happen, or something else should be taken on board. And that all happens, that goes back to the committee again then, does it?
Well, no, it doesn't go back to the committee at that stage. It'll go into the plenary session and all of the MEPs will vote on that particular amendment, let's say from an MEP. But the important thing at that stage would be that they'd need the support of their political group to get an amendment in at that stage, because they'd need some big backup at that stage.
Okay, so it's gone almost as a finished item.
Yeah.
And in order to amend that finished item, you'd need
some
the support of your very large group or a number of different groups.
And exactly.
I think that's where all the negotiation comes in then, that we'll support your position if you're an Irish MEP and you feel very strongly about that amendment. We'll support it even though it doesn't really matter to us as a group, because we need the support of your group for something else. So it's a huge amount of negotiation going on.
And it's happening in the council as well. So you can imagine the amount. And this is why, as you say, it takes time. There's also the thing, I mean, it's a very, like, in terms of the simple way of what happens to these laws, a lot of these laws not only have one reading, which is basically what they call it when it goes through the Parliament, it's having this one reading, but it may come back to the Parliament. Let's say the ministers decide, hold on a second, we don't like what they've come up with, we don't agree at all. At that stage, then the ministers will come up with some sort of a compromise, and that'll be sent back to the Parliament, and then we're going for a second go of all of that.
I know it's terribly slow, but it is also terribly democratic, isn't it?
It's terribly important if we're going to get it right as well, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
It really does make sense that you, by the time you sign up to something, you really have looked at all of the, dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. I have to ask you about the other huge power, new power that the Parliament has, and that's in relation to a new commission coming in, because we saw this quite recently with the new commission, that each of the commissioners went before the Parliament, and I suppose from an Irish point of view, we particularly watched Maura Geoghegan Quinn's performance. But the fact that the commission had been put together, they had all been nominated to different positions, but then they all had to go almost like a job interview to the European Parliament for the European Parliament to approve them. How does that work?
Which they would have done actually before. Do you know what I mean? It is something that has existed, but it became a bigger issue looking at this commission coming in, the amount of commissioners involved, the 27 commissioners involved, how important now the role of the Parliament is. I mean, really, what those commissioners are doing, or those, you know, candidates for the job are doing at that stage, is saying, look, these are my priorities. This is how I'm going to map out this particular area. These are the kind of draft laws that I'm planning on looking at for the next couple of years, which is important then. It's important to get the Parliament support at that stage, because they're the ones that are going to be deciding on them, and to make sure that the Parliament's priorities then come into it. I mean, it has become very important for the Parliament to try at that stage to influence what the commission is going to do for the next 5 years.
And can the Parliament, they do actually have the power to reject the commission, can they reject an individual commissioner?
No, that's a very important thing, because they can't actually, to get rid of a commissioner, the whole lot has to go, okay? Because the commission works as a college. That's what they call it, a college, where the whole lot of them stand as one, if you like, in these areas. And it did happen back in 1999, there was an issue in the commission, and the Parliament did meet to try and basically get rid of the commission. It didn't work the first time, they didn't get enough votes. And the second time they tried to do it, they were scheduled to do it, the commission actually resigned instead.
Very interesting. So they resigned presumably because they knew the Parliament had the vote that time. And
it was gone at that stage. Do you know what I mean? In terms of the issues that were there. So, which meant that a new European Commission came in at the time. It's become more and more important now.
So when the Parliament interviews the commissioners, it's not really like your final interview where everybody has decided you have the job. It really is their opportunity to say, we're putting you on notice. This is our agenda, and we want to see how much of our agenda you've taken on board already, and we want to try and influence a little bit more of it.
But you saw what happened this time with the Bulgarian candidate, where she unfortunately fell by the wayside. She was actually the Bulgarian foreign minister at the time. But because during her presentation, the MEPs had strong opinions on it. However, actually her candidacy was taken out. I mean, she was taken out of the picture by the Bulgarian government in the end, and a new candidate was put in.
Yes, rather than have the Parliament reject the commission.
But do you know what I mean? It became an issue because the MEPs felt so strongly during her three-hour interview. I mean, it's quite a gruelling experience.
Somebody said to me that Maura Geoghegan-Quinn was actually asked something like 65 questions by the Parliament. I mean, that is a gruelling experience for anybody who's coming into the job, particularly somebody who's coming into the job new, who's never been a commissioner before. It's a massive brief to get a handle on and to understand all the different perspectives within Europe.
But she did, do you know what I mean? There was a poll done afterwards in terms of the performance of the different candidates for the job, and she did very well in it because she did... get a handle. She was perceived to have gotten a handle on what she was going to do.
She's a pure politician, though. That's not to take from the other woman, but she is a pure politician. Yeah. Let me ask you one other thing. The one thing that I'm not sure how well it's used is each individual European citizen has the right to petition the European Parliament, haven't they?
Yes. This is
a good
one.
Is it ever used?
The Irish are brilliant at it.
Another thing we're good at. Okay, we've got the 1 minute speech and petition.
I don't know how we'd put that. But yeah, no, actually, relatively speaking, the Irish petition the Parliament quite a bit. It is a procedure. I mean, you have to go in on the website. You can do it in paper, but you go in on the website and you put together your petition. The important thing is that it has to have something to do with an EU law. It can't be because your neighbour is hanging out, do you know what I mean? They're washing too high or anything else. It actually has to have to do with some law.
And it can't be a national law. It must be something that impacts on the whole of Europe.
Yeah. Now, with that said, a lot of EU laws have now been incorporated into the Irish national system. So you will find that a lot of things do come under this. But making sure that it comes under that sort of spectrum is quite important before you go to the bother of putting it in. So we have a huge amount and a huge range of petitions. One of the biggest ones, I suppose, that has been there for the past couple of years is the farm in Kilkenny, where the farmer, Dan Brennan, is actually... has a problem with his cattle, that they're smaller than they should be. And the question is whether emissions from a brick factory, do you know what I mean, downwind from it, are actually sort of coming over.
Are affecting his cattle.
You've the safety of helmets that are being worn by people riding horses. Do you know what I mean? That was an Irish petition that came into the Parliament. You've road safety issues. You have environmental issues. You have dumps. You have roads. You have water. Do you know what I mean? And when I say roads again there, I mean the building of roads. You have the quality of water, because obviously EU law, water. Do you know what I mean? It's a very big issue. I mean, the Irish are brilliant at it.
It actually sounds like we've got a pretty good handle on how to use the system, which isn't bad for a small country. We'll have to leave it there. My thanks, Eimear Ní Bhriain, for coming in and really making the European Parliament quite fascinating.
Thank you
for joining us today. You've been listening to 103.2 Dublin City FM. This series was presented and produced by Ellen Gunning. Sound engineering was by David O'Grady. The series was made with the assistance of the Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe Initiative.